This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote ideas to the meaning of the word?
DHH is back.
Back on Twitter.
Back programming.
But not back in the United States.
Well.
Can you blame him?
No, I can't. I'm actually really jealous.
I don't think most people care like where he's at. I think it was that lack of controversial tweets that was more concerning.
The lack of Turbolink 6 and Stimulus version 2 for me.
Yeah.
There was some movement on Javon was working on the Stimulus repo a little bit, which is exciting. Maybe he's prepping some things for that. I don't know. Wasn't it promised like before the end of the year? Was Rails 6.1 going to be released by then, or were they just saying Turbolink and Stimulus?
I thought we were going to get Rails 7 by now, but that ship sailed a long time ago.
Well, so I was, like everyone, anticipating this new technology in April or whenever RailsConf was supposed to be pre-COVID. And then Hay got pushed back and subsequently all this new stuff. I would anticipate it before the end of the year. But is it like a thing where it's going to ship alongside Rails 6.1?
I don't think we really know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I think they'll definitely launch independently. And I would assume that like Rails depends on Turbolink. So I'd imagine the only real changes for that would be the Rails integration, you know, and upgrading, say, the scaffolds for that. Because right now they're doing local is false or local is true form submissions, and they can replace that with the Turbolink frame stuff. And Stimulus isn't really a thing in the Rails needs by default. So that can be totally independent, at least.
I bet we see Rails 6.2 and then we see Rails 7.
My hot take is that we're not going to see the Turbolink and Stimulus stuff this year. And honestly, I wouldn't blame them because I sat there and thought about, damn, it's been hard as crap to do a ton of stuff. And I just really wouldn't blame them if they didn't get around to doing all that massive amount of stuff for free that they said they were, given the circumstances.
Yeah, they probably also, with Haya's massive adoption, have been stress tested, all of that, you know, the new approaches and everything. So maybe there's some improvements they've been making to that too that we don't know about or whatever. I saw Casper posted a link to a PR that updates the Rails API guides, which includes now the sidebar with all of the classes and everything and Turbolink in there. So linking to any of those pages will include the sidebar navigation, which has been missing since forever, which is like really nice when you're poking around, you know, some API code trying to figure out which class some method's defined in. I just go to the Git, like the Rails GitHub repo, and poke around. But now you can do all that right on the API guides, which is going to be real handy.
Yeah, this is nice.
Show notes for that. But then also stuff like linking between, they called it deep linking, which I don't really know, just maybe referencing other classes and methods from the docs now works, I guess. So that is pretty useful. In staying, I guess, within this context too, with the nav bar and everything. It should be a nice improvement to the Rails API guides, which I feel like most people didn't ever reference because they were kind of clunky to navigate and stuff, kind of bare bones.
I would only reference it if it's where Google would take me. But like, I never was like, I'm going to go to the API guides to figure out this Rails thing.
Yeah. Same. Me too, for the most part. Or if I did land on it, I just go to the, you know, view on GitHub link and then poke around the code and be able to wrap my head around it faster. That should be a nice enhancement, but I guess that'll wait until the next release, probably before that drops.
Speaking of docs, there's a ton of Webpacker documentation in a folder in the Webpacker repo called docs. And a lot of people don't think to ever look there. And I didn't for a long time until I just stumbled onto it one day. And there's a lot of documentation in there that a lot of people probably don't know about. So Connor Rogers threw up a quick Bridgetown site with all of the documentation for Webpacker. So
that's handy.
Yeah, so it's like a really nice kind of like just web view of all the Webpacker docs. So that's at webpacker-docs.netlify.app.
Cool. That's really handy because, yeah, I always forget that stuff is written in there and it can be hard to like remember where that one obscure, you know, documentation paragraph was. And that should make things a lot easier and indexable in a better way, at least. So you can get to hopefully find those as results on Google soon then.
I referenced that when I first started trying to build Mad Men like last year and a half ago. I was trying to figure out how to use Webpacker with a Rails engine. And it was so difficult for me. It looks like it hasn't really improved much in terms of like documentation on it. Chris, what are you, now that you've picked that back up, have you gotten to that point yet?
No, I haven't. It's effectively the same issue as Stimulus Reflex and everything else right now. The real nice part about shipping JavaScript and CSS in your gem in the past with the asset pipeline was when you install Stimulus Reflex, you get the exact same version of the JavaScript to go with it. And at least as far as I know, there's no real easy way to pull that stuff in from a gem location right now. And I don't know if there ever will be. And, you know, the solution's just to publish a node module at the same time as you publish your Ruby gem, which is okay. But we recently added that to Stimulus Reflex to check the version of the JavaScript library to make sure that it matches the Ruby gem that you're using, that same version. And the versions, of course, are different, slightly different formats. So there's annoyances there. But yeah, I don't know if that's ever going to get improved. It really is frustrating because it seems like, you know, the JavaScript and CSS is required, but it's also secondary. And it's not like you can just say, we'll use the JavaScript and CSS from a CDN or anything. So I think my solution is probably going to be just to throw a Madmin JS pack in your application when you install it. And then, I don't know. There's no easy way of upgrading that, right? So that's like the downside to that. You know, you can do either that if you want the user to be able to customize it, or you can do your node module. And then you could do a combination of the two, I guess, and have it install a pack tag. And then require your JavaScript from NPM. But yeah, they can easily get out of sync and it's not a real easy thing to manage anymore. So I don't know. Upgrading is really the kind of big flaw to it all. So I don't know that there's been any new discussion about how to approach that yet. Have you guys heard anything?
I have not, but hey, listeners, if you would like to solve this problem, we will make it worth your while.
What are we giving them?
Yeah.
That it's a secret.
Oh.
I thought you were about to go into a Honey Badger ad.
Oh, no. I was about to do that in a few minutes, but no. I'm just like, there are a lot of people out there who are like, I want to build something, but I don't know what. And having a tool to manage both your gems and NPM packages together would be really nice.
I was just reading those docs. I didn't realize that you could import sprockets, like files from sprockets, into your Webpack stuff.
Yes. Isn't there the like assets.rb file where you can like import? I don't really know what I'm talking about. I just know what the file looks like.
Yeah, this thing is, you just give your JS file an ERB extension and you can use helpers.imagepath and pull like an image out of the asset pipeline. That's kind of cool.
Okay, that makes sense. That's interesting. You know, it feels like you should be able to almost add an extra directory in to look for the JavaScript and stuff. And you would think you should be able to just throw in like the have bundler point to the directory and, you know, we can just grab the JavaScript from source out of there or something. But yeah, I don't know. It seems like it should be solvable, but I haven't really dug into, you know, the threads about why they don't support that yet. But it would be nice if they did.
And I looked up what I was just talking about. I was thinking about assets RB that's in your initializers, but that is adding how to add stuff from Webpacker and your node modules into the asset pipeline, not the other way around.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's definitely some weird situations you can get into with that, I'm sure, like merging the two. And then like Sprocket's changed to the like manifest stuff. And I remember like with administrate, you've got to go modify your manifest.json manually to go add links to compile the administrate CSS and JavaScript. And yeah, it just feels things have gotten very disconnected since the switch to Webpacker, at least for JavaScript. And that's another thing too, is I want my JavaScript and CSS for Madman to be all independent of whatever you want to do with Webpacker. I want mine to compile separately. So it just seems like there's not a great way of separating that out, at least at the moment.
Yeah, I'm a very big proponent of using Webpacker. Like, I think it's great, especially because I write a lot of JavaScript. It does all the Babel compilation stuff for me. But there is part of me that misses the asset pipeline. And I really adopting just one or the other. This line down the middle is kind of weird right now.
Yeah, I like one or the other too. And I've done Webpacker. But to be fair, this like disconnect that we're feeling is also like just kind of a problem with Webpack in general. Because I started writing some Webpack configs. And I don't want to talk about why, but...
No, let's talk about why.
I was looking at the Bridgetown kind of basic Webpack config that comes out of the box, and Jared posted a tweet about how fast Hugo could compile like a website. And I found a few things in the Webpack config that could definitely be improved and sped up. And I'm not sure by how much, but we could get that number down even more. So I had been playing with this idea a little bit more prior to this because I found a really good resource that I will link in the show notes about all about Webpack. And so I learned all about it and I was just trying stuff. And it's just, there's ways to like improve Webpack, but like just the entire concept and the ecosystem and the tools, it's just, it's not good. I mean, it's great. It's better than what we had. And I'm not saying that they didn't build something great. Like the developers built something that no one else had. And that's awesome. I just don't think it's very good for what I want to do. And I feel like a lot of people feel like that, which is why people are trying to find other tools like Snowpack. Connor's building Snowpacker. We got Parcel, Rollup. Those are definitely nice, but it's just too much pain to like, I want this page to refresh when I update my assets.
Yeah, I hear that. It doesn't follow the philosophy of, you know, convention over configuration. It was very configuration heavy. And I remember that being the thing of when I first heard of Webpack, it was, oh, copy this massive config and then go tweak it and do whatever. And I was like, this does not sound like the philosophy that I want to follow here. I would like it to be smart enough to have some good defaults, not go copy this config from some random blog post that probably isn't totally what you want and you got to go fiddle with for hours and hours. That is not the Rails way. And that's, I think, a big frustration for a lot of people. At least Webpacker kind of made some good defaults and made extending that a little easier with like the Webpacker install Stimulus and Vue and React features, but you know, those are just tweaking the config for you. So it's not.
Yeah. But to be fair, the amount it does for you would kind of blow your mind if you had to sit down and write a Webpack config from scratch. All of a sudden, whoa, they're doing a lot. It doesn't seem like a lot, but they're doing a lot behind the scenes that you really don't want to be doing yourself. And like I said, to be fair, Webpacker is only as good as Webpack is. And at the end of the day, Webpack is just kind of clunky, dude. to literally just compile some JavaScript. Why do we need to compile the JavaScript? Why do we need to babble it?
Because we're trying to use features that don't exist in JavaScript.
Exactly. So how about we just stop doing that?
I mean,
I know they're not going to, but like,
I mean,
why?
The thing is, like, over the years, you went from we write all the exceptions ourselves to we use jQuery to do all the exceptions for us. And then you end up, well, JavaScript kind of sucks functionality wise. We need to add features to it. And then the browsers are starting to catch up with some functionality and improving JavaScript itself. And then there's all this work on JavaScript. And then people are like, but I want to use that feature from the next release today. And start trying to backport stuff. And then you end up with, you know, Babel and all the plugins, and CoffeeScript was an example of all that, which improved some functionality or weird, you know, nuances of JavaScript that didn't feel natural coming from another language like Ruby. And, you know, that came and went, which I prefer using Babel over CoffeeScript because it's just a lot more close to what you're actually going to run in the browser. I think that's kind of important. There was times where you would write CoffeeScript and then have to parse the JavaScript output of that. But when it fails in the browser and you're like, what the heck is all this stuff? And you're like, oh, it's because I wrote whatever, a class in CoffeeScript that it doesn't quite work the same in pure JavaScript. So they've got these like things it generates for you, and it's a pain to debug. But
I just saw a CoffeeScript reference in the Webpacker docs, and it was like deja vu. I hadn't thought about CoffeeScript in a couple of years, but when I got started in Rails, you know, that's what Rails shipped with. And I was like, you know, the train I was on was the RSpec, HAML, CoffeeScript, SAS, and then now my tastes have changed so much. Maybe because I worked on like a really big CoffeeScript project in my last job, but like now I'm like, give me all the ES6 and ERB. I don't know. I kind of want to get back. I don't. This is a statement that can get taken out of context, but like the more tools I use that are abstractions, the harder my life is.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. Like Rails itself is an abstraction, but I'm talking, you know, CoffeeScript is compiling down to JavaScript.
This is why you just write assembly for your web services these days. You're like, Ruby is built on C, which is built on assembly, which I might as well just write the ones and zeros myself.
That's why it's like kind of a slippery slope to say that. So I feel like I have to clarify. But yeah, I don't know.
There's like quality of abstractions though, right? You know, Ruby, you have a GC and everything garbage collecting for you so that you don't ever have to worry about memory management. Right. So it's like something that you could worry about if you want to, but like the value of that abstraction, not having to worry about it, totally worth it. And, you know, there may be times where you need to like actually care about those things where you might write a C extension or something and skip the abstraction. But yeah, I'm with you. There's a lot of value, and it depends on how good the abstraction is a lot of times, of like how organized it is, to the point of if you're writing Rails, you don't really need to know a fair bit of SQL, for example. You can just know the commands to write that will query the database, which is pretty sweet, but that's got its boundaries of usefulness that a lot of people, you know, find frustrating. And that's kind of an interesting thing of how useful an abstraction is based on how often do you have to go around the abstraction to get what you need done, I think.
The interesting thing about the ORM example is, like, with Active Record, I can still get down to SQL if I have to. I can just run a raw SQL query through my abstraction, right? But like with CoffeeScript, it was, I don't even remember if there was a way to just write raw JavaScript in it, or if it was just like every feature was transpiled down.
Some of the syntax you could do pretty much like regular JavaScript in a few things, but I would go to that js2.coffee site and then paste in the JavaScript and convert it to CoffeeScript and back and forth. And one thing that I find interesting is, you know, like we build Rails apps and use Rails UJS all day, every day, but like that's written all in CoffeeScript still. And still sitting in the Rails, you know, repo is just a bunch of CoffeeScript. And it always annoys me to go read it because I'm like, it'd be so much cleaner if it was just JavaScript, you know?
That's getting phased out. They're supposed to remove that.
Are they removing it and replacing it with just regular JavaScript or remove Rails UJS entirely?
I heard UJS was going away. Now that I say this, I don't know where the source is, but I thought this is just some old things to throw out. No, I'm very sure that I heard this because how would I possibly make this up? No, someone definitely said UJS was going away, and I feel like it was in the May of WTFs, and it was DHH or one of the core team members, and they were basically like, "We're done with UJS." While y'all discuss, I will look for it.
The problem with UJS for me is that I lose all of the features of Webpacker. So I just am left with, like, ES6, for example. I write a ton of ES6. Like, I think in ES6 now when I write JavaScript. And I have to be careful because while most modern browsers support it, if I write, like, a UJS JavaScript template, I have to write ES5. And it just feels like an antiquated tool in the tool belt now.
You mean, like, your server rendered JavaScript, create.js.urb. Yeah, I think that's going away with Turbolink 6, which is probably where that stuff is going to be able to get removed if they're doing the Turbolink frame stuff, I would hope. But there are some little things of, you know, the disable with that you can do on a button or whatever, where it will switch the button to be disabled while your form is being submitted. Some of that is, it's really nice that it's in the, you know, UJS library. And I don't know how they would replace that unless it becomes part of Turbolinks or something.
See, that kind of stuff I want to keep around. Those little like helpers. I don't know, even remote true.
Yeah.
Still just badass. And
I feel like that maybe can't go away, right? Because like the problem with the Rails scaffolds ever since Turbolinks dropped, which was one of the issues I posted way back when, was like, okay, you can submit a form with Turbolinks, and if it's successful, it does a redirect and takes you to, you know, the new blog post or whatever. But if it fails, you have to manually write your own create.js.urb response. And so Turbolink 6 is addressing that so that it can render just the frame and replace it.
Right.
So I'm wondering if all those features kind of like more naturally fit in Turbolinks and can get extracted from Rails then. Because they're all kind of like that, where like the remote form submit or, you know, the method delete for logout links, that really kind of feels like it fits inside of Turbolinks now instead of needing little UJS. Handful of helper methods. So I'm curious if that'll be something that joins that.
But does that mean for apps that chose not to adopt Turbolinks but did embrace UJS? I don't know. One of the ones I work at every day. If you just get rid of UJS, I mean, I guess you can get it out of Rails and keep it around as a separate library that you could bring in, but
yeah, it's a good question. I don't know.
That's like the Rails controller testing stuff. Like they yanked controller tests out in lieu of feature request specs or whatever. But then there's a maintained version of Rails controller testing that's just not in Rails core anymore.
Yeah.
Isn't it still under the Rails org though?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I would feel like that almost subsection of Turbolinx would have to be its own little module you could import, you know, independently rather than having to take over the whole UI with Turbolinx or something.
I don't know.
Or you'd really have to recreate that stuff.
I ebb and flow. I know I'm very inconsistent. If you listen to all like 101 episodes, I'll change my mind 79 times out of 100. But yeah, when you like fire up a new Rails stack and you use like all the things out of the box, like Turbolinx and all that, they really do just work so well together. So I am excited to see like how whatever is coming will work out of the box with Rails.
Yeah.
It's like that thing you mentioned, like the form thing. I just always use a local true and form with now because
right.
I don't want to have to write all that up. Just refresh the page. Give me the server errors.
Yep. And that was, you know, the Turbolinx render library is what I used in Jumpstart Pro because if you were, and that was another thing, was if you were going to use the Turbolinx iOS and Android adapters, they do not allow form submissions to make a regular post request, because that would actually clear out your JavaScript and your CSS and provide like a really weird mobile experience. So you had to submit your forms with AJAX, which meant that you had to have an easy way of handling the error responses. And the Turbolinx render gem was basically taking one of the, or there were several copies of the solution on the GitHub issues, but it was basically like, look, if there's an error response, then we can auto-generate a JS response and basically let Rails render the HTML, and we'll package it up and create a Turbolinx snapshot and have basically hacked Turbolinx into seeing this new HTML and replacing it on the page as your error response. It was a decent solution, but a little hacky. And, you know, really, you don't want to replace the entire page. You want to kind of like stimulus reflex to do. You want to just replace that portion of the page, which is where, you know, why the improvements in stimulus reflex have all gone down the path of let's allow you to morph just a section of the page instead of the entire thing. You don't lose your focus and your, you know, form field states and all that stuff. You can just replace the piece that you need, you know. And so I think long term, that is the obvious answer, and that's definitely going to be a piece of Turbolinx 6. So I don't know. Fingers crossed that that's all a lot easier. And we have all that JavaScript if you just inspect the Hey source code. So like the real piece that we don't know is just the server side stuff, which I imagine is going to be a little bit more complex than it used to be, because the only thing the Turbolinx Rails gem did was override the redirect to method in Rails and just say, hey, if this was an XHR request and you're doing a redirect and Turbolinx was enabled, then we will just replace the redirect response with a JavaScript Turbolinx visit and clear cache. And I'm sure that there's going to be a few more changes server side for this, but you know, hopefully it's a lot simpler. And I think they can probably hack the render stuff to do the same approach with this. So if anything, I bet you it'll be a pretty elegant solution, knowing how elegant Turbolinx in general was and Stimulus. I bet it'll be pretty slick when we get to see the final version.
I have a question for you too that's kind of related to this whole build pipeline, and it's related to security. But before I ask you that, I wanted to tell everyone about how other ways you can improve your security, and that's by fixing your bugs. So if you want to fix your bugs and improve your web security, then you should check out Honeybadger at honeybadger.io and get zero instrumentation, 360-degree coverage of errors, outages, and service degradation. Yeah, just use it, honestly. It's just so much better. that's all I have to say.
Yeah, it's nice. And I've used Airbit as my own like private cheap error monitoring service. But boy, you know, it seems easy to use. And then you're like, now I've got to update this thing regularly and maintain this app and run it. Just using the free plan or the low price plans of Honeybadger is going to save you the exact same amount of money of your time you would spend like maintaining that app on your own. So Honey Badger is so worth it.
Yeah. Don't believe the developer who says, hey, we should just self-host our error monitoring service, because we all know one developer who thinks that, but just don't do that. Just save yourself some time. Things are hard. Times are rough. Just don't make it worse. Just use Honey Badger. Okay. So my question though is, have you guys ever heard of security.txt?
No, I don't think so.
It is a proposed standard, but by proposed, it's basically becoming the standard. It's a file that you put in public in your application, website, whatever, and it defines a few security related... Did y'all hear that?
No.
Not really.
Someone just screamed something outside my window.
I just figured it. I thought I heard my kids yelling in the distance.
Oh. Security.txt allows you to specify, like, it's kind of like a key value pair where you can specify some information about your application. If someone finds a security vulnerability, who should they contact? And you can put your email there, and then you can put in encryption. You can have a list of people who have helped you with your security. So if someone, you know, spots a security vulnerability in your app or website and they fix it, then you can have an acknowledgement page. And basically, this just is kind of like a standard for, hey, if I find a security vulnerability, or I need information about the security policy of this website, or I found something and I need to tell someone about this because this is urgent, it's just kind of like a standard for defining that. And my question was, I was like, okay, this would be like a cool kind of like gem to create. And it seems like perfect for something that should just be in an, like a really simple initializer and just get built into public when you build your Rails app for production. And my question is that a thing? Because it's not really an asset. I know you can build all your, like, all the asset pipeline stuff right before you deploy. But this is like, okay, hey, before you deploy it, and other than it being like a build step, like in your, however you build your app, this is something that you can basically hook into Rails and be like, hey, whenever you start the server, for instance, you should build this file from this initializer and stick it in public. Is that a thing?
So is your question, how would you go do that?
Or is that a thing that you can do first?
Well,
because it's anything, not you can do an anything. Asset.
You can do anything you put your mind to, man. So if you were not doing it as Rails boots, which would probably, I mean, in theory, you could just set up a Rails engine that as Rails boots in production mode, you could build file, you know? But it's not technically an asset, but just like Webpacker does, what I would probably do is when you add your gem, add a extension to the assets precompile command and generate the file, you know, and just join that chain. Because that's really the only command other than, and migrations are something you run not on every app server. You would run migrations just once on a deploy. So, you know, that wouldn't necessarily be if you're deploying to, like on Hatchbox, you know, we run the migrations on your cron server, but not anywhere else. So we don't get duplicate rations running at the same time. So really the asset precompile is the only step of the build process you could hook into. Otherwise, you could hook into the Rails boot process to do it.
Okay.
But that would run every single time you boot the Rails app, right, which is probably unnecessary. So yeah, it depends on if you would ever need to do stuff as Rails boots, but I would probably put it in extending the assets precompile command.
Yeah, that was kind of like my underlying question is the assets precompile step really the only time that things get inserted into the public folder? And I think you just basically said yes, other than boot, but which I'm not going to do that on boot. So I didn't know how like much you could configure that step. So,
well, it's a reg task. So
okay.
If you write any code that, you know, prepends or appends anything into the asset precompile chain, you can do anything you want with reg there. So you should be fine. And yeah, I would probably do that. Just insert it into that step. It seems like the most logical place for it and keeps that simple.
Cool. Well, I'll stick a link to this in the show notes, but it might be worth checking out. I mean, anything you can do to boost your security, and I think is something you should do, especially if it's super simple, like adding a file to your public folder. I know all of the big companies have already done it, and I think the US government websites were supposed to do it as well.
So I noticed they want you to put it under the .well-known folder, which is same one that Let's Encrypt does with their Acme verification. So I guess maybe that well-known folder is becoming a standardized thing too. Yeah, it's becoming well-known. Huh. I'm just going to put please don't hack me in my security.txt.
Well, all I can think...
It'll be Amish security.txt.
I was just thinking like, yeah, that's what I want. I just want my email sitting in a TXT file in my public folder. People won't spam that at all, ever.
So put Jason's email in your security.txt.
Is your email has to be online somewhere. And this is more so for like companies, for people to report like security vulnerabilities on like Facebook and Google.
But you don't think people are going to make bots that just go...
Sure.
Nobody does that. Come on, Jason.
People definitely do that, but like your email is all over the place. Blog articles you've written.
Yeah, but Cloudflare...
Calendar invites.
Cloudflare does something that prevents just like the typical like mail to spam you get.
They have a little JavaScript or something that runs. I saw that in Active Admin or something. If I went to the user's admin page and it printed out the emails, I would see like a placeholder and then them get replaced with the actual text. So yeah, it must do that as it parses your response during the proxy step or whatever, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I don't know. I don't care if people have my email. I just don't want to get... I don't want to talk about it. Anyway.
We're tired. Are y'all tired? I'm tired.
Yeah, it's been a week.
It's just generic, we're tired.
I'm just tired. Tired of all of it.
Speaking of Mad Men earlier, I was working on generating routes in Mad Men. And basically, the routes are going to be nested under a namespace of admin or madman or whatever. And I was building the generator for that. And I know we've talked about this before, but building Rails bytes and generators in general, those helpers for generators are pretty rudimentary and frustratingly simple sometimes. So I made a PR this week in a screencast about building this feature or improving it. But the route helper in Rails always inserts at the very top of the file. So when you run your device install, like device for users goes at the very top and your scaffold goes at the very top and whatever. And that's just kind of annoying. And I found myself doing this a few times recently where I'll be reading the Rails master source code for a method to see what options I can pass in. And as I was building Mad Men, I was like, okay, well, we can check the routes file to see if there is a route or not for... you know, the admin area. And if there's not, we'll generate the namespace admin and put the resource in there. And Rails master has a namespace option. And I try and run it and it's like invalid option or keyword. And sure enough, Rails 6.0 doesn't have that feature. And the feature was added 11 months ago. So it'll be in Rails 6.1 eventually. But it's been around for like a year and I still can't use it. I was like frustrated with, but I modified that function again. So now you can specify, instead of always inserting after the routes draw do block, now you can specify and override that. So if you want to say after namespace admin do insert this line in here, you can, which is nice. So that should help quite a bit with that feature. And then the other thing was like the indentation of it always defaulted to two spaces. And if you were inserting inside of a namespace block, obviously you need four spaces because it's in two blocks there. So now you can customize both of those things. And hopefully that gets merged into to Rails core. But yeah, one of many improvements that need to be made on the Rails generators. I feel like they could be so powerful, but there's going to have to be a lot of little regex things that are customizable and whatever to make that function. You know, for example, if you want to capture the entire block for namespace admin, you would have to like search for the namespace admin and then do a not greedy regex until you found a line that was like a new line space space end, and you know, make sure you got the correct end block instead of any of the nested ones. And you can see how going down the rabbit hole can be with writing generators to edit files that you don't exactly know the content of.
Yeah, that's one of those little pain points that I hadn't really thought of, like how painful it is. And because I actually just skip route generation when I use generators. I override, like I don't generate helpers, I don't generate something else, and routes is one of them, because it's, I never want my route at the top of the file.
Yep. So that should be easier in Rails 6.1 at least. What's also nice though is like I wanted that feature of Rails 6.1, but I'm using Rails 6.0 now. So I just copy the route method from Rails 6.1 into my generator. So I've got all of those options and I just override the method and works like a charm. So I can use it, you know, in any Rails version instead of just waiting and being only compatible with Rails 6.1, which I think is a nice enhancement. But you don't want to always override those methods. It just gets annoying. That was the only thing I needed to override. And it seems to work nicely because now, you know, I can check and see if the namespace admin exists. And if it does, we'll use it. And if it doesn't, we'll insert it. That alone probably warrants a extra method here. Does this route exist? Does namespace admin exist? And it wouldn't be much different than a reading a file and checking and grepping for a line in there. But yeah, I don't know if it goes, because most of the methods in the generators are like commands to go do something, not just check. So it'll be interesting. Maybe that's stuff that we can add to the Rails generators in the future.
Well,
looks like Andrew had to run to a meeting. So
Andrew had a jet and I need to jet as well.
Yeah, me too.
I have lots of stuff I want to talk about, but we go our own way today. So
the good news is that there's always next Friday to talk. So it's like your weekly therapy session when you want to complain about the asset pipeline and Webpacker and stuff.
Yeah, the stuff my therapist doesn't understand. So
yeah, they're like, is this guy insane?
Cool. Well, have a good week and we'll see you next week.
All right. See you, man.